Okay.
Yeah, you'll talk straight after me.
Okay, so the mic is there, I should be facing the person, and you press the silver button to
okay.
Play.
Okay.
The numbers will move on.
The numbers will start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
Cool. I assume it's open a bit. you can correct me if it's not. Great, well, welcome to today's conference, Bataille's Sovereignty in the Human, Exploring Bataille, the Cursed Share Project, which is a three-volume work of Bataille, which we're hopefully going to be focusing on, but I think it's more broadly his work in general. We have three panels and three keynote speakers dotted around. We have Oksana following me, and then Howard Cagle and Scott Wilson, and Eddie O'Connell at the end of the day. Before we have Oksana, I'd like to briefly give some coordinates with which we can grasp Bataille's thought, in particular the Cursed Share, and to generally lay the conceptual groundwork for the day ahead. Bataille's synthesis of previous philosophies is remarkable. St. Thomas Aquinas, Heidegger, Hegel, Kant, Nietzsche and Marx are all utilised and alloyed into a philosophy that is not so much the bastard child of each, but more like the messianic redeemer of all. Bataille brings death into the philosophies of life before him. The question as to what life is still debated, the general consensus being that it's fundamentally organisational, process-based, inseparable from its environment, and intrinsically connected or concerned with itself. Life is the process of engagement with the environment so as to recreate itself at all times. We eat, we increase our energy, we repair any damage to our organism, and we reproduce and grow. Bataille sees in the philosophy of life a common deficiency. Death does not exist for it. If it is addressed, it is the negation of life, the end to the accumulation of energy, the anomaly to life's production. Contrary to this, Bataille reinstates death in, its universal primacy. Life is in fact the deviation from death, the negation of being's decline. Life is at odds with the universe. But death is not just the death of an organism. It has a specific sense. Death is the end of a process, the time when work is over and energy has finished being produced. It is the final cause beyond all productive final causes. Bataille's exemplary image of death is the burning sun. The sun dispenses energy, wealth, without any return. The sun gives without ever receiving. The sun does not live, but constantly burns, unloading its resources upon its environment until finally it will have no more energy to relinquish, its gift bag empty. We are the subjects of this superabundance. Subjects, that is, in the dual sense Foucault described. We are the subjects of the sun's power, inundated with an energy that exceeds our needs, leading to a waste or expenditure on the one hand, and we are experiencing subjects of such superabundance on the other. We feel the excess of energy passing through us. Imagine the figure of someone being stripped to a skeleton by an atomic blast, but instead of being destroyed, the energy animates our bodies into action, charging us with more than enough energy for survival. Biologist Dr. Lynn Margulis writes, in perfect synchronicity with the Accursed Share, life is planetary exuberance, a solar phenomenon. It is matter gone wild, capable of choosing its own direction in order to infinitely forestall the inevitable moment of thermodynamic equilibrium, death. Of course, life cannot in fact infinitely forestall death, and Margulis notes this unequivocally. So what do we do with this abundance of energy? It can either be wasted or spent, but either way it will escape us. This is the question of sovereignty. Now, I isolate sovereignty as Bataille's core concept. There are other possible candidates, the sacred, for example. Sovereignty is ethical, political, ontological, and aesthetic. In this way, Bataille is akin to the German idealists of the previous century in his philosophical ambition. In order to flesh out what sovereignty means for Bataille, I want to point to two passages from key influences upon his work, Nietzsche and Kant. Bataille writes, late in the third volume of The Accursed Chair, that, and I quote, "I am the only one who thinks of himself not as the commentator of Nietzsche, but as being the same as he," unquote. Bataille reads Nietzsche's genealogy of morality essentially as a genealogy of energy use. The slave, turned inward on himself, bitter towards all free force, is, on Bataille's reading, utilitarian man striving through rational planning to drive all sovereignty from existence. This servile man has been bred into existence through the decline of traditional modes of sovereignty, religions, monarchs, etc. In their place we have the management, production, and functionality of everything. But, just as it is ludicrous to expect a strong force to pretend it is not strong, it would be laughable to expect life to banish death. For Nietzsche, sovereign man is the ripe fruit at the end of a long line of slaves, aware of their shortcomings, and ready to reawaken previously stunted force towards new creative ventures. For Bataille, sovereign man utilizes the abundant production of the servile utilitarian past, note the difference between utilization and utility, and takes part in the energetic wastage that the sun compels it to produce. He is not a monarchist or a religious fanatic, or a being reduced to animality, but one who seeks the sovereign life that underlies these forms. Sovereign man affirms life, just as in Nietzsche, but life is the passage of death, the expenditure of life. This is Bataille's response to the problem of nihilism. To understand Bataille's Nietzscheanism further, we should look at the second of Nietzsche's untimely meditations. There we encounter the different species of history available to us, and the different forms of life that utilize history for the present. Interestingly, for Nietzsche, it's the past that has the potential to become a chain, the potential to become a chain for humanity, whereas Bataille sees the future as that which has the potential to make us slaves. Both agree, at least in this text of Nietzsche's, that man can only have being only when he stops becoming. For Bataille, the becoming of death is paradoxically experienced phenomenologically in moments that are utterly present. Okay. Enough about the Bataille-Nietzsche links. Well, it's enough about being and becoming. Nietzsche portrays the individual who understands that instead of naively clinging to life to the point of denying anything dangerous or new, simply circling in self-preservative sameness, instead of this biological life, Nietzsche proclaims the ethic, and I quote, "He lives best who has no respect for existence," unquote. This rings with situationist passion. These individuals know how to regard life with, and I quote, "Olympian laughter, or at least sublime mockery. Often they descended to their grave with an ironic smile, for what was there left of them to bury? Only the dross, refuse, vanity, animality that had always weighed them down and that was now consigned to oblivion," unquote. The life that does not respect life presents a distinction between two types that should not be conflated, or else at risk at least two nihilistic conclusions. And this is why I think Bataille is particularly relevant today. First, if organism life is conflated with an ethics, then the human is given a nature that is self-preservative and uncreative. Essentially, life would be that which merely survives with as little fuss as possible. Second, the reduction of human life to biological life is fundamental to biopolitical principles. Foucault claims as much when he talks of the reversal of Aristotle's political animal definition. And Giorgio Agamben, following Foucault, sees the politicization of natural life as the condition of power's grip upon individuals' very mortality. Cooper Francis's paper, which we will be exposed to shortly, still will hopefully expand upon the relationship between Bataille's and Agamben's philosophies, and Oksana's discussion of the human-animal distinction, played out in Agamben's work, amongst others, will hopefully throw further light on the framework of life at play in Bataille, in particular looking at the concept of animality. Bataille's neo-Kantianism comes, as I see it, through his aesthetic philosophy. Sovereign aesthetics is summed up on the first page of Volume 1 of The Accursed Chair. It's a line from William Blake, "Exuberance is beauty." This finds its precursor in the first half of Kant's Critique of Judgment. Section 16 of the Critique of Aesthetic Judgment distinguishes between two types of beauty, free beauty and merely dependent beauty. The first, Kant claims, presupposes no concept of what the object should be, and as such the object is self-subsisting with no external purpose. The second does presuppose a concept, and as such the beautiful object is dependent upon the external purpose of which it serves. Judging something in its purposelessness is a pure judgment of taste, whereas judging something to be beautiful in its perfect serving of a purpose is impure. Kant gives the example of a building that is a church. Its beauty cannot be of the free kind, for it is merely dependent on its serving a purpose, the function of a church. We could give other examples. An aircraft might be considered beautiful in its ability to serve its purpose so efficiently and with its parts in complete harmony. A termite colony might appear beautiful in its devotion to itself, each individual termite dedicated to the preservation and maintenance of the colony at large. For free beauty, Kant gives examples of marine crustaceans, flowers, and wallpaper, which he thinks have no intrinsic meaning, represent nothing, and are free. The beauty of a flower is not reducible to its biological functions. Its beauty is judged irrespective of whatever vital purposes may be involved. This is, for Bataille, the aesthetic distinction between servility and sovereignty. Bataille's criticism of Kant's account would be his somewhat arbitrary choice of examples for each type of beauty. Bataille provides a scale for aesthetic judgments. For him, uselessness is, to put it crudely, the yardstick according to which a thing is more sovereign, more free, and in fact more attuned with being itself. All things are universally useless. The degree to which the object embodies the affirmation of the excess of a purpose and utility is the criteria for its judgment. Like Kant, Bataille also uses the example of home decoration. But unlike Kant, wallpaper is seen as the comedy of sovereign existence, a poor shadow of the exuberance of life that beauty truly is. The bourgeois couple that put up wallpaper are certainly taking part in the movement of excess that exceeds them, but in their activity they, and I quote, use art without knowing what magnificence it calls into play. So free beauty, for Bataille, is both more ubiquitous than Kant would have it, and yet is more often not naively subordinated to functionality and utility. Art is not, as Alain de Botton would have it, therapy. To determine beauty as useful is to be the slave human. To determine beauty as excessive a function is to take a sovereign perspective. Bataille, in fact, gives us a surprisingly blunt list of moments and activities that qualifies freely beautiful, sovereign. I quote from chapter 3 of part 1, laughter, tears, poetry, tragedy and comedy, play, anger, intoxication, ecstasy, dance, music, combat, the funereal horror. I like how ecstasy and dance music come straight after each other. The magic of childhood, the sacred, the divine, the diabolical, eroticism, beauty, crime, fear, disgust. We must also add to this list community, of which Bataille strove to realise amongst his friends and contemporary intellectuals. Bataille's aesthetic philosophy will hopefully be expanded upon further later on with the final panel of the day with Professor Roy Boyne and Machiko Ogi. Okay, so hopefully that introduction has set the scene, and I'll now let Oksana give her paper. So, Dr. Oksana Timofeeva received her PhD in philosophy from the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow in 2005, her thesis concerning the problem of eroticism in Bataille. She's written numerous articles and two books, the first, Introduction to the Erotic Philosophy of Bataille, and the second, which I've enjoyed reading recently, The History of Animals, an Essay on Negativity, Immanence, and Freedom. She's currently carrying out research at the Humboldt University in Berlin, where she has an Alexander von Humboldt Research Fellowship. Her paper is called Bataille and Beasts, so please join me in welcoming Oksana to Bristol.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Michael, for hosting me, and thank you all for coming and attending. Should I speak louder somehow? And please forgive me, my English language is not my native language, far from that, and I hope you will. Okay, I start. I will start from epigraph, from Bataille, from his short text called Metamorphosis. Man, despite appearances, must know that when he talks about human dignity in the presence of animals, he lies like a dog. For in the presence of a legal and essentially free being, the only real outlaws, the stupid feeling of practical superiority gives way to a most uneasy envy. This talk is just a modest attempt to approach such an intricate topic as a Bataille animal or a Bataille beast. The animal or the beast? This is the first question, which brings us from the very beginning to the two different sides or two different meanings of animality in Bataille's philosophy. These are respectively immanence and sovereignty. From the former to the latter, there is a long path through the whole of human history and particularly through the history of eroticism. The connection between an immanence of the animal and the sovereignty of the beast is neither clear nor obvious, and I will try as far as I can to clarify, first of all, by addressing the idea of the beginning of history and of the end of history, where the figure of the animal occupies a really crucial place. And of course, I leave aside, so I do not touch, I will just focus on one small discussion, let's say, or virtual discussion, leaving aside the very important topics related to Bataille and animality, like sacrifice or something. We can then pick it up during our discussion if it will happen. So I will start from immanence. Animality is immediacy and immanence, Bataille says in the Theory of Religion. Bataille and animality doesn't know negation or rupture and maintains itself in a kind of continuity of life. As emphasized by Benjamin Noyes in Bataille, I quote, "The world of animals is a world without difference because animals know nothing of negativity and thereby know nothing of difference." It's all right for Bataille if one animal divorces the other, since it doesn't clearly differentiate itself from its prey. Both eating and being eaten, they share some pulsation. The generosity of life transforms into the exuberance of death, as Bataille says famously. Every animal is in the world like water in water. Human world in Bataille is something completely different. The very difference or differentiation is there a principle. Animals are indifferent. They don't differentiate between themselves and others. They do not care. They are immersed in a continuity of life. On the one hand, there are animals in the immanence of nature. On the other hand, there is a historical humanity with its negativity and transcendence. Bataille thought itself presents a scene of conflict between these two irreducible levels of being. And Bataille draws a special attention to the genuine desire of human beings to separate from everything natural, animalistic, dirty, barbaric, and so on, and to the connection of this desire to an actual inequalities, social inequalities, cultural, and so on. In fact, he says, people and cultures which we characterize as primitives are no less close to animality than we ourselves are with all our civilization and technical development. Moreover, their distance from natural forms of life can be even bigger. Their rituals with respect to nature or death, sexuality, can be even more rigid, and the fear of nature can be even stronger. There are different degrees of human dignity or human quality, humanity, depending on someone's place in the social hierarchy. As Bataille points out, the more rich and powerful is the person, the less animal and the more human is it, he or she, in terms of symbolic quality. It is, first of all, a human separation from nature, which gives rise to social and cultural hierarchies and divisions. This is super clear in Bataille, especially the history of eroticism and so on. While investigating the traditional archaic institutes and everyday practices, Bataille is trying to understand and to show how deep inside we bear the roots of injustice and inequality. It's not easy to get rid of them, that's what he's trying to show, but not in order to justify them as right-wing conservatives, for example, do, but in order to find a subversive element in the very heart of this phenomenon. So, according to Bataille, the history of humanity starts from man's separation from nature. I quote, Man is the animal that negates nature. He negates it through labor, which destroys it and changes it into an artificial world. He negates it in the case of life-creating activity. He negates it in the case of death. End of quote. However, do you hear me now better? Or yeah, okay. However, Bhataya negation of nature is not that much an overcoming or like a dialectical aufhebung, but rather a violent exclusion. A full transformation of nature is nothing but fake. Nature is neither eliminated nor fully transformed, but excluded. It is now outside of the border of prohibition. One might call it repression in a psychoanalytical sense, but I doesn't really talk about it in these terms, although here and there he draws parallels between the sacred and the Freudian unconscious. These parallels, in my opinion, are very important, and we should keep them in mind, especially when talking about animality. First of all, the negation of nature coincides with prohibition. But in turn, prohibition itself is to be negated or transgressed. Thus, a passage from animality to humanity goes in two directions. The one of the world of prohibition, useful activity, labor, knowledge, language, morals, and laws, and the other of the transgression, plays, art, poetry, eroticism, and so on. Therefore, human world is always divided into two by the line of prohibition. By this side, we have the profane and beyond the sacred. Thus, the sacred appears out of nature through its negation, and thus animals become gods. I quote, something unfamiliar and disconcerting came into being, something that was no longer simply nature, but nature transfigured the sacred. In a basic sense, what is sacred is precisely what is prohibited. Bhataya's world is made of distinctions, although one can also say that on some material level, Bhataya's world is made of shit. Between human and animal, distinctions between human and animal, between human and natural world, and in the human world, between the profane and the sacred, and within the sacred, between left and right, then between sovereignty and slavery, and within sovereignty, between power and freedom. It's a super complicated system of this duality. And we can even distinguish, after all, between two different freedoms. The one is the sovereignty freedom, I would say, desired by humans, the one which makes them to make all the way through history, through negating nature in prohibition, through negating prohibition and transgression, and so on and so on. And the other freedom is the immanent freedom, which was there among animals from the very beginning. For instance, a sexual freedom unconsciously experienced by animals and utterly unattainable for humans. I think there is a certain paradox in Bhataya's versions of animality. Due to this paradox, history cannot end, or at least cannot have a happy end, as far as the sovereign freedom cannot meet the immanent freedom. There is some discrepancy between, let's say, bestiality and animality. As Bhataya says, history would be ended if the disparity of rights and of living standards was reduced. History cannot end, but can just collapse. And as he shows in his book Sovereignty, even communism, which aims to eliminate differences and inequalities, cannot provide a proper answer to the drama of history, because even if it eliminates all the differences, it is still based on the very principle of all differentiation. Basically, as I would interpret it in Bhataya, the limit of communism is humanism. And as Bhataya puts in Sovereignty, I quote, if the universal man of communism has a value so great that it is criminal to exploit him, he gets it from the ancient curse of man by man. The man of classless society owes the value in the name of which he destroyed the classes to the very impulse that divided humanity into classes. No one can deny it. The respect due to man is meaningful only insofar as I remain associated with the impulse that led men of all times to contest the humanity of all the others. Often this contestation is crude, but without it there would not have been any humanity, since at bottom its initial impulse was the repudiation of animality. End of quote. I will now try to make a deeper examination of the question of the end, but also of the beginning of history, starting from Alexander Kojève, from whom Bataille borrows this question, together with the idea of a human being as the negation of nature, and to whom he opposes his own idea of unemployed negativity. I will try to show how Bataille Agamben, for example, replied to Kojevian thesis on the end of history, and what can be really interesting about that. As is well known, it is very influential and constitutive for the entire generation of French thinkers, although very misleading, as many Hegelians would agree. A commentary on Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, Alexander Kojève proclaimed that the history is over. Nothing really new can ever happen on the earth. To make the long story short, the beginning of times, according to Kojève, coincides with the appearance of man. Before this moment, there is no time. There is only natural being or space and animals which inhabit this space. The history starts when, at a certain point, one of those animals turns into a man. The appearance of man, I'm sorry for this man, I'm just reproducing this this Kojevian, you know, kind of style, and also like man from the, it is written from, the appearance of a man as an active, suffering, fighting, and working nothingness will introduce history and time in the process of negation of the natural given manifold of being for the benefit of his, of man's supernatural ideal goals. I quote, man is negating action which transforms given being and by transforming it transforms itself. People open the history, which will be then the history of struggles, wars, revolutions, through which they actively change the world. The principle is such, however, that the point of the end of history should coincide somehow with the point of its beginning. This means that at the end of history, human beings should turn back into an animal again. Kojevian history makes its round only once, with no repetition, and this is the history of becoming human, which is already over. To finalize the history, man just has to create a universal homogeneous state of mutual recognition, a state of total satisfaction of all the desires. Following Kojève's logic, this point is actually already achieved. There is nothing for it but to fit a certain social reality, to find the right state, which now will be a model for a further post-historical unfolding of the same. At the end of history, man does not need to change the world, to work and to fight any longer. Satisfaction is possible here and now. The task of Kojevian history is therefore to turn the unhappy animal into a happy one, and a human being or history or time or negativity is nothing but the long way between the two. However, after all, there is one question here which makes the entire story kind of interesting. What or who remains after the end of history? In 1948, Kojève acknowledged that if at the end of history man becomes an animal again, this is already here and now. And he explains in his notes to the second edition of his Introduction to the Reading of Hegel, I quote, kind of a long quote, so I understood what is important. Okay, I hope you can tolerate it. I understood that the Hegelian Marxist end of history was not yet to come, but was already present here and now, observing what was taking place around me and reflecting on what had taken place in the world since the Battle of Vienna. I understood that Hegel was right to see in this battle the end of history properly so called. In the end, by this battle, the vanguard of humanity virtually attained the limit and the aim, that is, the end of man's historical evolution. What has happened since then was but an extension in space of the universal revolutionary force actualized in France by Robespierre Napoleon. From the authentically historical point of view, the two world wars with their retinue of large and small revolutions had only the effect of bringing the backward civilizations of the peripheral provinces into the line with the most advanced real or virtual European historical position. So you see how nice is the idea now. However, Kojève was never totally sure where exactly the history ends. At a certain moment, he had some expectations towards Stalin, but then he related the end of history and the return to animality, of course, to an American way of life with its extended consumption. And this is the most, famous, this idea, because it was picked up by Fukuyama and others, and it's very easy to associate it with the globalization and the contemporary capitalism, basically. But after his visit to Japan, as you probably all know, Kojève completely changed his mind. After observing famous Japanese rituals, he realized that man can even go so far as to commit a suicide from pure snobbery, just enjoying the beauty of the form. No animal can be a snob, said Kojève, and actually rejected his main idea of the death of man and related the end of history to this formal snobbish Japanese perspective. One more quote with some cut. All Japanese, without exception, are currently in a position to live according to totally formalized values, that is, values completely empty of all human content in the historical sense. And the other one. This seems to allow one to believe that the recently begun interaction between Japan and the Western world will finally lead not to a reverberization of the Japanese, but to a Japanization of the Westerns, including the Russians. Now, since no animal can be a snob, every Japanese post-historical period would be specifically human. End of quote. Thus, finally, in making his choice between the man and the animal, Kojève decided for the man, for the Japanese, for the one who, instead of going back to the animal condition, gives himself up to a free play of forms, which are now liberated from all the content, from all the noise of time, of history. What remains after the end of history is not an animal, but on the contrary, it is precisely what is human in man. And what is human in man is not history, not politics, not fight, but his fundamental, fundamental formal opposition as subject to some objective content. After the end of history, this opposition is finally free of all this noise of time, since the form is purified of the contingency of the content. The man without content is the name Giorgio Agamben will give to his philosophical book dedicated to art. Talking about Hegel, Agamben points out that in fact Hegel never assumed that art is dead or that art is over, but that art transcends itself and goes beyond itself by its self-negation, and that the self-annihilating nothing is in a way embodied by a certain pure gesture of art, which is rather incapable to die. I quote Agamben. Artistic subjectivity without content is now the pure force of negation that everywhere and at all times affirms only itself as absolute freedom that mirrors itself in pure self-consciousness. I will refer to yet one more book by Agamben, where again he discusses the post-historical question, The Open, Man and Animal. At the very beginning of this text, Agamben refers to one miniature from a Hebrew Bible from the 13th century found in Ambrosian Library in Milan, which represents a messianic banquet of the writers, of the judges, of the last day. Agamben pays attention to one interesting detail of this miniature, I quote, beneath the crown, the miniaturist has represented the writers not with human faces, but with the unmistakably animal heads. This image is described in the very beginning of the book, in the very first chapter. The second chapter refers to Bataille, and the third one to Kojève, with his idea of a post-historical snobbery. Agamben shares Kojève's idea about the end of times, but trying to answer the question about the remnant, he does, another choice. What remains after the end of history in Agamben is actually the animal. But this animal is precisely the most intriguing part of the entire Agambenian drama, let's say. It is not that much a consumerist human animal like Kojevian Americans, but rather a kind of sabbatical animal from the night of whose profound boredom a messiah will come. The animal life, the bear life, and the eternal messianic life are endowed with the same ontological status, which is extremely high. Here are characteristic of Agambenian life, shifting from the bear and the animal to the messianic and the divine. The rest, the eternity, the Sabbath, the doing nothing. Bataille, in his own response to Kojève, also talks about life. But this is another life which does not know rest. Life is, he doesn't actually mean life. In this case, life is a conceptual persona for negativity. In his letter to X, lecturer on Hegel, written in 1937, Bataille famously says, I quote, but of course you know this quote, but I cannot resist it. So it's so important. If action, doing, is, as Hegel says, negativity, the question arises as to whether the negativity of one who has nothing more to do disappears or remains in a state of unemployed negativity. Personally, I can only decide in one way, being myself precisely this unemployed negativity. I would not be able to define myself more precisely. I don't mind Hegel's having foreseen this possibility. At least he didn't situate it at the conclusion of the process he described. I imagine that my life, or better yet, it's a bulging, the open wound that is my life, constitutes all by itself the refutation of Hegel's closed system. You see, this is a kind of hysterical reply. Like, so what about me? But I present in his body, his life, as a counter argument to the to this idea. What remains, according to Bataille, is thus this open wound of his life as negativity, which still persists, precisely as he explains further, it will persist in the work of art, but in which supposedly there is no need anymore. the humanity of the human, which is already thrown away, the obscene trash of desire. According to Bataille, then, an open wound in human beings is produced, first of all, by voluntary negation of its animal nature. This mechanism of production of human identity through detachment from animality and explaining negativity as an exceptionally human phenomena is, of course, quite Courgettian. At the beginning, according to Bataille, there was an event of separation from animality, a prohibition, a negation of ourselves as natural beings, which occurred in the old days. That's what Bataille calls the first step of the human, which is the beginning of history. But precisely this idea of the first step comprises one of the biggest, again, like in Courgette, at a certain point, a certain animal turns into a man. And this is the first step. And it comprises one of the biggest paradox of Bataille anthropology, not actually realized by Bataille himself. In fact, it's not a man. It is an animal who negates itself, being the subject of this supposed very first historical, or rather prehistoric, negation or transgression. There should be an animal who, all of a sudden, look how in his Tears of Eros, does he describe a first man who starts to practice funeral rituals, for example. I quote, "However, these men who were the first to take care of the corpses of their kin were themselves not yet exactly human. The skulls they left still have ape-like characteristics. The jaw is protuberant, and very often the arc of the eyebrows is crowned by a bony ridge. These primitive beings, moreover, did not quite have that upright posture which morally and physically defines us and that affirms us in our being. Without doubt, they stood upright, but their legs were not perfectly rigid as are ours. It even seems that they had, like apes, a hairy exterior which covered them and protected them from the cold." In order to become the only animal who negates itself as an animal, this creature had first to be an animal which suddenly, for some reason, rises, stands up, straightens its legs, and says, "I'm not an animal anymore." And by standing upright, he thus exposes his sexual organs, which he immediately covers with dress. And this first, so how come that from the immanence of animality, from the animal doesn't care? This is the video. Did you get the point, right? I guess so. This first step can be described as a drama where Bataille's human being loses some primordial continuity and immanence of being. The immanence of nature then is given to the human being always as lost. Knowledge and the shame, knowledge of differences, ethical, sexual, etc., and shame of being exposed in these differences, feeling guilty, these are definitions of both Christian and Bataille man, a creature of the fall, of the original sin. Both are nostalgic towards this lost paradise or nature. The birth of man in Bataille, the birth of man in Bataille coincides with the birth of art. He dedicated a number of his writings to the prehistoric, namely Paleolithic cave paintings, and especially to the one in Lascaux Cave. In particular, I quote, "In particular, the most moving image is found in Lascaux, in a part of the cave that is so difficult to access that today the public is not admitted, in the bottom of a kind of a pit. A giant bison, losing its intestines, is depicted there in front of a dead man, apparently dead. other details hardly render this strange composition intelligible. I cannot insist on it. I can only recall the childlike aspect of the image of a man. This aspect is even more striking since the dead man has the head of a bird. End of quote. So this mask or the animal head of a man clearly refers to various aspects of totemism. The prehistorical worshipping of the animal comes, first of all, from the evidence of its primordial kinship with humans. Second, it marks animal primordial superiority over humans. They are the ancient gods, and therefore cave paintings are literally the icons of the Neanderthals. I quote again. This moving figurations oppose in a way the figuration of man, what we must consider the inferiority felt by primitive humanity, which worked and spoke in front of the apparition of the silent animal which did not work. In principle, the human figurations in the case are of lesser quality. They tend towards caricature, and they are often concealed beneath an animal mask. In how not to compare in this respect the Bataille prehistoric man depicted in Lascaux beneath an animal mask and with the Agambinian post-historical judges with animal heads. This round circle of the prehuman and the posthuman of the Bataille unemployed animality and the Agambinian sabbatical life brings us back to another aspect of Bataille animal, which refers to the problem of sovereignty. Animals do not work, says Bataille. They are sovereign. In his article Friendship of a Man and a Beast, he says that some of them are actually working on men, of course, and yet they are not completely employed. They kind of, in doing their labor, they stay strangely detached from it. They keep in themselves a kind of serenity and freedom. They have a kind of a potentiality to stop working at any moment, like a horse all of a sudden galloping off. If they get carried away, we will never stop them. Bataille animals enjoy their freedom without knowing about that. They are sovereign, but their sovereignty is immediate, whereas in humans it goes through mediation. One needs to work in order to then freely destroy what has been produced. Let me take two examples. The one of proletarians and the other of philosophers. But I'm speaking about the worker in his book Sovereignty and about himself in Theory of Religion. When they stop working and negate their unfreedom by a simple act of drinking wine. I quote, two long quotes, but they are beautiful, so please forgive me this. Okay, so first from... about himself from Theory of Religion. Now I place a large glass of alcohol on my table. I have been useful. I have bought a table, a glass, etc. But this table is not a means of labor. It helps me to drink alcohol. In setting my drinking glass on the table, to that extent I have destroyed the table, or at least I have destroyed the labor that was needed to make it. Of course, I have first completely destroyed the labor of the vine grower, whereas my absorption has only destroyed a minute amount of the carpenter's labor. At least this table in this room, heavy with the chains of labor, for a time had no other purpose than my breaking loose. I'm now going to recall the use I have made of the money earned at my work table. If I have wasted part of that money, wasted part of the time, the rest enables me to live. The destruction of the table is already more advanced. Had I just once seized the moment by the hair, all the preceding time would already be in the power of that moment seized, and all the supplies all the jobs that allowed me to do so would suddenly be destroyed. Like a river, they would drain endlessly into the ocean of that brief instant. End of quote. And the other one about the warfare from sovereignty. If I consider the real world, the worker's wage enables him to drink a glass of wine. He may do so, as he says, to give him strength, but he really drinks in the hope of escaping the necessity. That is the principle of the labor. As I see it, if the worker treats himself to the drink, this is essentially because into the wine he swallows there enters a miraculous element of savor, which is precisely the essence of sovereignty. It's not much, but at least the glass of wine gives him, for a brief moment, the miraculous sensation of having the world at his disposal. The wine is downed mechanically, no sooner swallowed than the worker forgets it. And yet it is the source of intoxication whose miraculous value no one can dispute. And of course, drunkenness will never turn us back into an animal. To paraphrase Kojève, no animal can be an alcoholic. Drunkenness will never return us to the continuity and immediacy of nature, but instead it is itself a kind of mediation of this immediacy. And I borrow this last kind of definition from William Schlusser, who in his book Post History dedicated a chapter to drugs, which he defines as media, or as the mediation of the immediate. Drugs, including wine, makes public what's supposed to remain private or deeply intimate or secret, a certain experience which effectively mirrors our culture. Art, according to Flusser, is a special kind of inebriation, since after having, I quote, after having mediated between man and the immediate experience, it inverts this mediation and makes it so that the immediate becomes articulated, that is, mediatized towards culture. End of quote. It publishes the private or turns conscious the unconscious. In this sense, Bataille and prehistoric artists too experience this drunkenness. They are inebriated by their transgressive touch of the immediacy of the animal world, which they immediately mediate. Thus, drunkenness is one of the very human ways to experience sovereignty, not as power, but as autonomy or freedom, is in Bataille all about unemployed negativity, which, as he thinks, he opposes to the Hegelian negativity. What would be then a Hegelian reply to all this mess? Or even, what would be a Hegelian animal reply to Bataille and philosophers, workers, and prehistoric and post-historic humans? Let's call them artists. In fact, there is a crucial difference between Kojevian and Hegelian negativity, ideas of negativity. And I would rather say that Kojève was wrong when he was interpreting it, negativity, as something specifically human, as the very essence of man. According to Hegel, negativity, and therefore subjectivity, is there already in every creature. If one wants to get a perfect example of negativity and at the same time of drunkenness, one should go back to an almost insane passage in Phenomenology of Spirit, where Hegel criticizes self-certainty, compares animal with an initiate of Eleusinian mysteries. I quote, long but brilliant. I really love this passage. In this respect, what one can say to those who make assertions about the truth and reality of sensuous objects is that they should be sent back to the most elementary school of wisdom, namely to the old Eleusinian mysteries of Ceres and Bacchus, and that they have and that they have yet to learn the mystery of the eating of bread and the drinking of wine. This is so because the person who has been initiated into this secret not merely comes to doubt the being of sensuous things. Rather, he is brought to despair of them. In part he brings about their nothingness, and in part he sees them do it to themselves. Nor are the animals excluded from this wisdom. To an even greater degree, they prove themselves to be the most deeply initiated in such wisdom, for they do not stand still in the face of sensuous things as if those things existed in themselves. Despairing of the reality of those things and in the total certainty of the nullity of these things, they, without any further ado, simply help themselves to them and devour them. Just like the animals, all of nature celebrates these revealed mysteries which teach the truth about sensuous things. So one might see in this Hegel and Eleusinian animals a kind of subversive of parody on a Cartesian cogito, suspended between its own self-certainty and the armchair radicalism of its doubt about the sensuous world. It's not that these animals have some doubt about the existence of the sensuous objects. No, they are despair of them, and in despair they negate those objects. Their animality resumes as subjectivity through the negative gesture towards reality. They are always in this move from their immediacy, or to be precise, in Hegel, their simple immediacy is nothing. It doesn't make sense. What counts is always this movement of mediation towards a greater freedom, which basically the animal organism is. As subjectivities, Hegelian animals lack freedom. A little bit of Hegel at the end. The natural being of the animal exposed to the contingency of environment and to the dangers of life with its potential violence brings it to the state of incessant alteration of health and disease, and make the animal essentially, I quote, insecure, anxious, and unhappy. So the very life of animals in its essential sickness, unhappiness, and anxiety already contains in itself this force of negativity, which can express itself as an anxiety, or as Hegel says in Science of Logic, an unrest, I quote. The unrest of the something in its limit in which it is immanent, an unrest which is the contradiction which impels something out beyond itself. End of quote. So not only an animal in its natural milieu, but every something knows, and this is a chapter called Something in the part of the book which Science of Logic, there is the chapter called Being, and within Being there is something about something, as you all know. And so every something knows and experiences this unrest, which Nancy, for example, will call the restlessness of the negative or the becoming. Every something at every moment is pushed beyond itself in its desire not to be what it is, to the desire to leave the place it or he or she occupies. For example, it's the lack of free will which does not allow animals, in Hegel, to stay erect. That's why their bodies run parallel to the ground. Although, as compared to plants, which are still attached to the earth, animals already at least freely determine their movements, and the human being stands up. In a way, one would say that Hegelian animals, which run parallel to the ground, are essentially drunk. They are drunk to the point which Bataille, proletarians, and artists cannot ever reach. Becoming human jumping into history is the only way to get someone more sober. That's how one stands up from the ground. Hegelian animal requires history. There would be no history without the animal's unrest. Thus, in his reflection about the prehistoric man, Bataille actually tends to be somehow unconsciously more Hegelian than Courgette. Unemployed negativity is not that much a refutation of Hegel, but rather its corollary. Isn't it that the one who stands up, this Bataille first man, is in fact this very kind of Hegelian animal, which never coincides with itself? A human being brings this animal throughout its history towards its very end. It seems that unemployed negativity, which Bataille poses on the side of the human, art, laughter, eroticism, play, whatever, comes in fact from this desperate animal whose unrest again and again makes us human. Those who want to finalize history should first of all send this animal away. What is then about immanence, should one ask? I would say the immanence of animals and the immanence of nature is a retrospection, a delusion even, but a kind of necessary delusion, a vision produced by the drunken beast, which is always already human, of a certain primordial unity before the rupture between the now and the before. Hegelian lesson is that it is in fact this very rupture, this split, which was before. The difference itself before the differentiated. Without it, human being would never come into the world. History would never start, and we would never experience all these problems. On the other hand, the necessary retrospective delusion of the animal immanence is of the same nature as the Freudian return of the repressed, where the repressed itself is produced by this very repression. So it coincides. It's one and the same thing. But I write saying that if communism is to eliminate inequalities and differences, it should finally deal with this essential split of the human itself. His idea that we can find some truth of history in the erotic experience of man or woman rightly indicates this point of unemployed animality between the Freudian animal unconscious and the difficult Hegelian freedom between the animal and the beast. So this is more or less it. I hope there will be some questions.
Great, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Well, I've got some questions. Hopefully people will be thinking of theirs. Well, so essentially, the reason why animals can't be drunk, or the reason why, and you pointed out what you called, a paradox between the animal and the beast, or a kind of a contradiction, and that the mediator between that is this essentially Hegelian dialectic between the animal must pass through the human before it becomes the sovereign beast at the end. That's what, as in that essentially what I see, it's quite a bait, it's like a standard dialectic in Bataille. And that's why there is no going back, because from the beast to the animal, it's like a total sublation from one to the other. And my question essentially is this a problem? I thought you could kind of say that this is kind of a
this is what I was thinking about this very morning. If this is a problem at all, because the reading of Bataille makes you think that this is precisely the problem, or this is almost the main problem of how can we get there where we cannot get. So we can somehow it's interesting. I was trying to to draw, but like to make a kind of schema of this dialectics.
Mm, mm.
And I was trying like yesterday to put everything on circles, like where is the like the human, the animal, the immanence, the sovereignty, the beast, the labor, the sacred, the left, the right, and like the circles of different sizes, and how to make a circle out of the circles. But there is like something which doesn't work. So first of all, they cannot keep themselves, like they cannot keep a circle. Like it's always like this broken circle, ruptures in their circle, and there is this rupture between the sovereignty of this and the anima, the immanence, because. Well, because the immanence does not exist, apparently, and...
I thought it was that the immanence of the animal gets negated by the human labor, which is future-orientated.
That's what Bataille is saying.
Yeah.
Like it gets negated, but like it appears precisely like as a kind of, like, it in itself is being produced by this negation.
Mm.
That's what I'm
okay.
trying to say through this old circle between Bataille and Hegel.
Yeah, right.
So Bataille kind of projected this immanence, but then if we make this passage, it makes us to conclude that this immanence part is a projection. That's why we cannot get an access to there, even though we make all the way and we finally arrive to the point of the beast.
Mm.
Sovereignty, almost there, but like kind of at a highest degree of negation, transgression, and so on over dialectics or negative dialectics, we are even more detached from the immanence of nature than before. But at the same time, we should we kind of cannot but presuppose the existence of this immanence, out of which we appeared, actually.
Mm, yeah.
So
we're kind of on the threshold between the human and the beast, in that we're projecting backwards to the immanence of the animal, but we're almost on the threshold of reaching the immanence of the beast, and
yeah.
You're saying we might not be able to get
there. Is it a problem or not? I think, I think it is a problem, because it is a problem of the beginning. There is a problem of the beginning, what was at the beginning, partly Nancy is right when he is criticizing, because you know this all this critique by Nancy, for example, of Bataille's idea of community, that is basically where in operative community, Nancy criticized first Heidegger, then Bataille, from the idea of this retrospective utopia of a certain primordial community, a certain primordial unity, and so on and so forth. And Nancy is saying, oh, this is a mistake. This is basically like, this is a kind of like reactionary kind of thought. But there is a problem with this very idea of deconstruction, that was a certain mistake in the philosophy of the past to invent a certain greater past. Whatever, but this is not a mistake. So the problem is, it's the very same because, it's a projection is a style in philosophy. So Bataille might think that the prehistoric men were so naive to believe in the fact that their totem, they derive from a certain animal and so on. But also Nancy himself is so naive to believe that, but I believe that and I believe that Nancy was so naive to believe. whatever, so if this is can be like taken, this can be, this is not a problem. So the retrospective utopia, this is not a problem, but there is this question of the beginning where this Hegelian-Lacanian idea of the initial difference is something relatively new, and something more radical, anti-Christian, I would say. Just to clarify it a little bit, apart from Bataille, the difference itself, the differentiation itself is before the what was produced by this differentiation. So the beginning is after the end. So not after the end, but the beginning is the result of what was after the beginning. Simple, quite simple.
Yeah.
Why this is important? Because it's like basically.
Why something rather than nothing? But essentially, it's a mutual implication of yeah.
Yeah.
Alison.
Could you ask about your reference to the ice cream colours and to think about how you're beginning this one at the end?
Can you please speak louder?
Okay, sorry. I thought I was speaking. Okay, I'll stop. Can I ask you about your reference to the critique of communism and in the context of your critique of at the end of the talk. Is it not possible to say that the principle of idealized communism, not communism as it actually happened in Eastern Europe and so on, but idealized communism, the principle from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, that principle could be seen to be akin to an idealized notion of the animal. But you're saying, according to your critique, that the animal already has negativity in it, and you're reading Hegel in Hegel, Hegelian reference to the animal, this is the animal, whatever you call it, activity already contains negation. But couldn't you say that there are degrees of negativity, and that in some way the idealized principle of communism, despite the type of critique, is closer to it's not negating nature to the same degree as many other forms of human activity, and that therefore there could be this kind of Bataillean rehabilitation of communism but accepting your Hegelian critique of the type, sorry, that's all over the place.
I've got the point, but it's a super interesting question. A Bataillean critique of communism itself is very interesting, I would say, and I never properly work on it. Apparently he deals with the also in this accused share, he deals with the two notions of two ideas of communism. The one is like the real existing socialism, which is kind of the negation of negation and the negation of the sovereignty. So it's a negative sovereignty per se. At the same time, he deals with the certain conception of communism as something which is based on this principle of equality, of a universal humanity. And which contains this paradox, because if we talk about the universe of humanity, then the difference between the human and animal still persists, and it's precisely this difference due to which inequality occurs. But this is not the question, of course. The question is about it. Can be the idea of the ideal animality a point of critique of the really existing communism, and the levels of can the levels of negativity be reduced, right? In a way, maybe I do not get it. I do not formulate it correctly, but I think that not. I think that, first of all, let's say communism is not nice. That's the problem. There is a difference between communism and communism. Communism is not a lost paradise without the difference. So the very idea of communism, which is taught in this way, should be deeply reconsidered, and to reconsider it, we should take into account this unconscious element of the restlessness. The idea is how to think communism negatively, not positively, not as an immanence of nature, which we will finally, which we are supposed to finally reach. So why communism is not the consumerist paradise when you just go to the shopping mall, just the difference is everything is for free and you do not work. So this is the immanence of nature, but in a kind of the negative conception of communism, which is about, first of all, about violence, then about ambiguity, and about this unconscious element of not the human but the animal nature itself, is something which should be somehow taken into account and taken seriously, this is not a dead idea. Communism is still have some perspective, but I think in this light of negativity, not in light of immanence, so this is a different line somehow.
We're going to have to leave it there and grab a coffee before Keegan's talk. So,
Was it that long?
Yeah, quite long. Help yourself to biscuits. They're not just for ornamentation.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah. It's like a chapter. I mean, it's 2 points, like an upgrade.
Yeah, upgrade.
Yeah, the new stuff. So I was excited.
This chapter, there is something which I do not understand, but then I was working.
Well, actually, really, because I was reading a chapter and then going back to retire, then